Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, as it is. And this conversation, I'm going to kind of launch us straight into it. I think this is a continuation. This will be part three. It's actually part two for us that's having it, I guess. But it will be part three in terms of podcast conversations with Alexander and Ylva. And after our conversation, after where we left off last time, I read a couple of books and felt like I deepened my understanding of what we were actually talking about last time, which was some sort of new conversation that's happening that you've, I think, very aptly named Conversation 2. And so we will be there, but what made me realize that I really didn't get it, or maybe I got parts of it, but I felt like I had understood more of what we were actually talking about. And as I re-listened to our last conversations, I was like, oh, there's so much here that was left on the table because I couldn't hear what you were saying from where I was then. There was reading Vanessa Andreotti's or Mercato de Oliveira's book, Hospicing Modernity, a couple of times. And then I also read Dougal Hine, At Work in the Ruins. And those two, especially Vanessa's book, I think is a very, very valuable portal for entering into this conversation. So I'm going to kind of just, I might actually have done some sort of other summary or something like that before this, as we go into it, if that's useful. And I'm just handing the space over to you, and I'll try to tag along the best that I can from where I'm starting. Alexander or Ylva, whoever wants to kind of take us on.
I think I want to leave it to you, Alexander, right now. I suddenly got this tiny bit nervous. I don't know why. I wasn't nervous a second ago, but suddenly.
Yeah, thanks. I'll try. And thanks, Amit, really, well, for everything you do and the way you're holding space for all these really good conversations. And thanks for having us back. I think, as we said last time, Ylva and I have been on this yarn for several years now. And the luxury of being able to invite other people into this yarn and maybe even stimulate other people's thinking through it feels extremely privileged. Where we left it maybe last time, or rather where we were last time, was in the exploration of the conversations that take place outside the conversations that are focused on the world as we see it today. We can call it many things. We can call it liminal space, liminal conversations, or conversations in that liminality. Charles Eisenstein likes to talk about the space between stories, that we are leaving a world of one story, which he calls the story of separation, and moving into what he calls the story of interbeing. Let's not focus so much on what the next story is. Let's focus on this space in between the stories. In a very, very commonly quoted line from the old Italian Marxist Gramsci, he liked to talk about that the old world is dying and a new world is struggling to be born. Now is the time for monsters. So all of this, these conversations take place in what we would call a particular room. And we've chosen to call it the antechamber. The antechamber is, you know, it's the space between houses, between rooms. It's that in-between space. And antechamber, is as good a term as any other. So that's why we thought today we'd talk with you a little bit about the antechamber. And you can talk about it in many different ways, of course, and the natural place to start is looking at the conversations that take place there, the what, the, you know, why, going into theories and models, and all of that. But we thought we'd at least start from another angle, not jump into the substance and the theories, but rather think a little bit about the question of who are in those conversations, who participate in them, who should participate, and then maybe move to the where. So where is this antechamber? Where should it be? What are good places for the antechamber? And then also maybe roll up our sleeves a little bit and talk about the how. Ylva and I professionally have a long background in, you know, hosting, designing, convening, curating various conversations of different kinds. So it's been very rewarding for us, I think, to put that lens on and to think about the antechamber from that perspective. So if it's okay with you, Amit, what we thought we'd do would be to walk through some of these questions around what goes on in the antechamber and how you and we and others perhaps can either join into the ongoing conversation in the, let's say, the general antechamber, or create your own antechamber for your own conversations, your own liminal conversations. And hopefully some of the things we say might prove useful for you.
Full stop. Yeah.
Line that starting point, because I think it's really important. And otherwise, yes, please take me to the antechamber. let's go there.
Yeah, well, first I would like to say that because the antechamber is also, I mean, anyone who has been between jobs or projects, like in the in-between space, knows that it's not entirely comfortable. This discomfort is, so the antechamber is really what we want to talk about, is an approach to how to handle these very necessary conversations about the world that wants to be born, because that's more of a focus, even though the antechamber can also host conversations about what's wrong with the old world that's dying, what is dying and what are we leaving behind and so forth, and saying thank you and appreciating the phases that we've been through and saying goodbye in an honorable way, just like Vanessa Andreotti or Vanessa Mark wrote. And to handle the pain and also acknowledging the fact that with this antechamber, the room between rooms, making sure that you don't stay there all the time and not stay there too long. It's okay to not be in the antechamber, even though you've realized, I mean, every day, all day, it can be quite toxic to be there, to kind of dwell in there, especially if you're on your own. Because it's as though the antechamber needs structures, it needs, or at least it benefits from a form of organizing in terms of who and where and how and so forth. And the deeper you go into the new or imagination of the new in terms of opening up deeper and listening deeper, the more of a container and holding space is needed. It needs to be really, really strong and not to be underestimated also, I think. Please fill in, Alexander, Amit.
Yeah. What I want to say also maybe initially here about the antechamber is that at one level, this is the, you know, this is the space, the kind of conversation that most future thinking, futurizing has been about. And you know, this is by no means a new discipline. And in the world of, let's say, in the world of business and even civil society, the world of theories and concepts for how to talk about transitions and how to talk about the future, this is a space that's been, you know, quite often covered. So from some people will feel, you know, what's new with this? This is something that we know. And just to say a few words about what that antechamber or what those conversations might look like from a more conventional perspective, this is very much the world of, you know, in a lot of business environment analysis and trend analysis and scenario planning and business strategies, etc. This is what's been going on there. And, you know, one fairly common way of looking at the future is, again, starting from where we are now, and you look for what some people would call there's the projected future, the kind of official future, and then there's the probable future, which is the forecasts. And then you have the plausible futures. There you usually add an S and it becomes plural and it becomes scenarios. And then you think about possible futures and preferable futures if you look at it more normatively. And then, of course, there are the, you know, preposterous futures. Those six P's I saw the other day in an illustration that went a little bit viral in my circles. And it's very, very useful, but it only covers part of the story, because all of that begins from where we stand today. And so going back to the metaphor of the antechamber, if the antechamber is what happens when you, is the room you enter when you cross the threshold away from conversation one, which is all about what the world looks like and what's wrong or what's right with the world and what's happening, and you step out of that conversation and maybe you turn around and you look in another direction, then these are some of the things that come up. But there are other things that come up, wouldn't you? And maybe you can add in here, Ylva, about the less conventional ways of approaching the conversation about the future.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at it, if we regard it as a spectrum where the conventional, projected, probable, plausible, possible, preferable, preposterous futures would be on one end, and then on the other, very, very extreme, would be transcendence and mystic experiences. And somewhere along that line, and depending on also, I mean, and that on the other end of that spectrum where we approach transcendence, this is where we open up to the fact that there might be another interesting cosmology, i.e. another interesting or many other interesting views of how the world works. And where you open up to exploring what could such worldviews be like, and where you're there, and that in, you know, on that end, it also encompasses, you know, the psychedelic experiences, but not necessarily psychedelic. But it does have to do with entering or creating where you make the antechamber into a ritual space, I would say, a more ceremonial space even, that allows for a very deep liminality. Was that clear?
I'll put some words in, chip in some words, and then and we can see if I'm heading into the right door. The way that I perceive these conversations is that often is that they deal with what I would call as like deep time or like deep knowledge, like these types of the, it's like beyond the normal time or beyond the sort of the normal experience. Like it's, and then they are also to me, the information flows in through multiple channels. So they're like multisensorial in some way. They're both, but they're really sort of, I think what Buddha, like they part of, like the subtle body is very, very much part of it. Like there's a different extraordinary or supernatural sensing, if you will. And I mean those words in their very literal meaning, and anyway. And then I was also, one thing that I wanted to maybe add to what you said, like on that other end of the, if the six piece were on one end of the spectrum, and then there was this sort of the transcendence and the mystical, and then there's also something around, and that's informed, of course, by like Nora Bateson's work, but like some sort of subsendence. I don't know if that's a word, or like submerging, or like something like that. That there's the transcendence is not necessarily just floating away up deracination. It's definitely is more multi-directional or omnidirectional, and it rises and it sinks and it decays and it grows, and like there are all these different sort of entangled movements that seem to be happening at the same time, and also seem to be, I don't know, there's a my experience of it is that there's a deep intra-affordance as well sort of happening, like that there's like a full, very little determinism, lots of dependences, lots of entanglements, and everything has consequences, but it's not, it's consequential. Things are consequential. Like there's feedback loops and like entanglements. I'll stop there. I can't find the word.
Just to add one component to this, which I think captures part of what you were saying, Amit, is the fact that a lot of the, let's call it the conventional ways of investigating futures are very analytical, very mind, very, in that sense, you know, you can call it academic, mind-based. And that's very much at the center of the all the forecasting. And I mean, both Ylva and I worked, with scenario planning and futurizing for decades. And that's why we sometimes call ourselves that we're recovering futurists, partly because, and in the recovering, what we say is that we have accepted the limitations of the analytical mind when it comes to all these things. And at the other end of the spectrum are also a lot of ways of sense making that are not going through the mind and through the intellect. So let's step into the antechamber then. Why don't we begin asking the question? So, who do we meet there? Who would we want to meet there? Who's in there? Ylva, do you want to start?
Yeah. And of course, building on where we stand in terms of conversation two, and acknowledging that the old world is dying and that a new one is waiting to be born or in the process of being born. I don't think anyone who isn't pondering this particular question would be so much interested in this antechamber, even though anyone is invited. But it's if you are very, very determined in that the fact that the old world is not dying, this is the world that is, and we're going to keep it this way. An experience within the antechamber might not be very desired. So I think it's whether you're drawn to exploring this topic. And then there could also be a spectrum even there. If you're drawn to it, you get mildly curious, but you could also be wanting to deliberately visit the antechamber or create the antechamber in order to experience and explore what would, for example, another cosmology be like, and also to explore even your perceptions in terms of how can I receive information in other ways than through the intellect. So there are many different questions that can be asked and before entering the antechamber, but that's a different story. We can move on to that later on. But so that to respond to the question who, that's a general reflection, and then fill in, Alexander.
Yeah, what one framework that we presented last time, that we described last time, and that's been very, very useful for me and for our conversations is this little thing called the ladder of awareness that the Canadian psychologist Paul Shifurka, psychologist and Buddhist Paul Shifurka, wrote about a decade ago, where he walks through the step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and talks about how each step is a step into a wider awareness of the challenges in the world around us. He talks about a step 1 of being dead asleep. And there we can say that very few people at step 1 would even be interested in the antechamber, wouldn't even entertain the idea that there is something called the antechamber. I'm being a little too facetious here, but I think, I mean, in his description there of the step 1, these are very much people who, for various reasons, at that precise moment, are very much in the moment and not really thinking much about neither about the problems nor about the wider future. Step 2 comes when one big question, one looming challenge turns up in your mind, and that becomes the all-encompassing and all-absorbing issue that you spend all your time on. It can be climate. In our context, it maybe usually has been climate, but it can also be any other big single issue. Moving from step 2 to step 3 involves realizing that there is more than one challenge, that there are 2 or even 3 or even more. And you are left with the bewilderment and the frustration of not really knowing which is the most important challenge, which is the most important problem. Moving into step 4, which involves the realization that these challenges are actually interdependent, that these challenges feed on each other. These problems are part of a wider situation. And that a solution to one problem is probably not a solution to another problem. And this moves then to step 5, when the very notion of a problem with a solution becomes called into question, and you look at it rather as a general predicament rather than a set of particular questions and problems with answers. So taking that and asking the question and bringing it back to the antechamber, we don't know, of course, but we would probably argue that the notion of the antechamber is particularly relevant to the people fairly high up or very high up on the Shifurka ladder of awareness. So step 4, step 5, because that is when you are beginning to look for the other narratives, the other, you know, the other bodies of work, the other approaches to how to think about the present and the future.
I'd also like to add that this is with regards to the particular antechamber that we're talking about now, and of course there are many antechambers everywhere and that are relevant for everyone, depending on situation in life and so forth. But just to enter the antechamber of conversation 2, where we explore the new world that is in the process of being born, what it could look like.
Just a couple of the observations, and again from how I perceive that space shortly, but like one aspect of it seems that the existential aspect, it I don't know if it has to be present, but there has something to do with a certain level of pain or a certain like acceptance of loss, which has to do with the dying world. It might be related partly at least to that. And then to have made the step that it becomes personal, that it's not about out there, at least not solely about out there. And maybe even transcended that it's solely about myself, that like it's something around sort of the dynamic and the flow and the pulse of maybe learning. Like we're not escaping either into ourselves or to somewhere else. Yeah. Let's put it that way at least. And the direction seems to be pointing very much to here to me. Like that it's not a way. It relates to the escaping too. Just wanted to.
Yeah, thank you.
And maybe just add one thing, which is also an observation about the kind of people that have inspired us, have inspired me, and I think also you, Amit, is also the fact that the antechamber will seldom be a university institution. There is something around a purely academic exploration, which for various reasons has at least meant that the people we spend time with and we like to talk to and we admire are generally, at least maybe they have one foot in academia, but they most definitely have the other foot outside of academia. And you mentioned, you know, Dougald Hine or Nora Bateson. I mean, they're not professors so-and-so at some big institution. Vanessa Andreotti is, but I haven't met her. I've been on video calls with her, but she does not strike me as a tenured professor very much focused on having her peer-reviewed articles published. It's something very different. So there is something around I know sometimes I think Nora Bateson sometimes calls herself an alt-academic, that there's something around the antechamber being at least outside the conventional places where conversations about the present and the future take place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot, and I couldn't agree more. It can even be, I think that if you enter or approach the antechamber with an approach that is very academic and very analytical only, then you will become the elephant in the porcelain store. You might overthrow the whole purpose of the antechamber. It's a delicate, it's really a delicate state, I would say, and a delicate room.
As you were speaking to it, I got this sort of image of the balancing, like if we are with one foot, like they're not so close together, but they're kind of one foot in each world, in two different worlds, then in order to be able to balance those two, then your body has to be in between something. And so that kind of goes for the Swedish word, like the mellanrum, like the space between spaces or something like that. I mean, you kind of, not automatically, but there's a way that you can inhabit that while you're shifting between these two feet or like shifting your weight.
Not like the epic split of Volvo trucks.
Exactly. Well, maybe it depends on how far apart your worlds are, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if they diverge even more, which will force you at some point to decide which side you're going to move to, because you can't stay with one foot on each truck for how long, for forever.
Or you fall into the abyss.
Yeah, exactly. Where the monsters are.
Right.
So that was a little bit about the who. And I guess we started veering towards a question of where is this antechamber? And reformulating the question a little bit, what are the places, spaces, venues for the liminal conversations that we have been talking about? Ylva, do you want to start?
I want to start with the approach that say that you want to be having such a conversation, and what would be a good place for such a conversation. But it could also be what have historically been good places for such conversations. Since there's a need of a container, it could either be in nature, of course, I've noticed with the events and the burns that where, which are all of them containers for deep transformation for many people, usually take place in out in nature and in such a way that you even, you know, you sleep in tents and on the ground and you spend several days together in nature and it makes a big difference. So, but it's also sometimes, since I host drum journeys where you definitely go into a dream state and you want to explore. You ask a question before and you enter it. And my experience is that the drum journeys need a walls. I've hosted them both indoors and outdoors, and I've noticed that four walls is actually quite handy when doing this work, and where the doors are closed and cannot be opened during the time when you go into a deep altered state, when you and you do travel in non-ordinary reality now to go into the more, you know, transcendent type of experiences. But I know you have also some examples, Alexander, of great places for the antechamber.
Yeah, I'm not at all an anthropologist, but I know that in many indigenous cultures, if you look at a culture, especially a place-based culture, they will have specific places for different occasions. There will be places for ritual and ceremony. There may be places for judgment, for, you know, trials. There are places for dancing, of course, and et cetera. And I'm pretty sure that in many cases, there are also places for good conversations. And that everyone in that nation, that tribe, that culture knows that when we go there with the intent of having a good conversation. And then, of course, there are also rituals surrounding those conversations, and we can come back to that a little bit later. So I just want to start by saying that that the antechamber isn't everywhere, or if it is everywhere, it's at least better, or the conversations are better in some locations compared to others. Another observation that I've felt actually more strongly recently is that places where there is a history of good conversations are often, they're often conducive to good conversations now and going ahead, going forward. I think many of us have experiences of such locations. Just to mention a few, I mean, in Sweden, I don't know how many, if you, Amit, have spent much time at Sigtuna Stiftelsen, Sigtuna Foundation outside of Stockholm, which is it's an institution and a building that's over 100 years old, and it was created to have good conversations. And somehow, at least for me, when I go there, and I've both participated in many conversations and hosted, something about the history of all the conversations that have taken place there comes back, and yes, it's a room with four walls and a ceiling and a floor, but there's something more to it, which means that for some reason, and now we're very much into, what for some people is very woo-woo, but for others is something that many of us have experienced, that there's something about this place that means that the conversations here are really very good, tend to be very good. I think I've never been to Esalen Institute in California, but many people talk about that as being such a place, and there are a number of others. Why it's like that is very hard to say. How come it started there is a bit the same question as, you know, why was the church built here, or the temple, or the mosque? What's special about this place? Well, at one level, nothing. At another level, people will say, well, yeah, because there's something special about this place. There are some places that are better than others for being the strong container that these kinds of conversations and explorations need.
I would also like to point to the lack of spaces for the antechamber. I mean, there's no ongoing antechamber for conversation two in the world that is wanting to be born. And in Sweden, there's not many of those, sometimes events, sometimes certain conferences, some podcasts like this conversation right here in this room. And I would say, because you and I, Alexander, we have conversations like this, but only like one-on-one or two, I mean, very small groups and individuals that we talk to. And there's more and more of us, and there is a longing for the antechamber. That's how my perception of it, like a permanent place that could host this, and if not permanent, then at least temporary. And we've also discussed whether we want to host them or not, but as of yet, we haven't found that this is where the energy leads us, but that might change, you never know.
There's, I don't know if it belongs under the headline where, but there is something, because we're dealing with subtle aspects of something, I hesitate to use the word reality, but these subtle aspects. At least my experience is that it's really, you have to be quite fine-tuned in your discernment as well, in terms of the where. Of course, there's what you're pointing to, Alex, like there are places and so forth where you can have these conversations in a better way, but it's so much about the, in a way, the intention and the ritual and the coming in and also daring to leave behind certain things and maybe pick them up once you leave. I don't know. We've been working with, in online spaces, I've been invoking this image of a meadow where you travel far to get there. And then as you're standing on the edge of the meadow, the invitation is to put down your backpack, like whatever that heavy thing that you've been carrying, all of that knowing, all of those ideas, all of those presuppositions, all of those identities, let's just leave them for a little bit, rest them against the tree. And then we step in. You know, maybe you'll even take off some of your clothes, like some of those pieces of clothing that doesn't fit anymore. The stuff that you've grown out of or that it didn't really quite fit, or there's like a bunch of holes in the jacket or whatever, like all the stuff that you love for one or another reason, where it's clear for you that they're not just sort of the function, but they carry other strings. Those are the things that we might need to care for, being able to store somewhere somewhere where we don't need feel like we were going to lose them, but that we can try on a different reality or try on a different aspect of being or something like that. And then we step in, and then when we step out again, we can pick up what we want. That's the invitation as well, to bring with us and get dressed again in the stuff that we want to, and let the other stuff maybe be or give them away. So there's something around that aspect which I think is, I want it to be said, and I don't know if it.
Yeah, and the symbolism of that with physical items is quite important. This is has a real symbolic meaning when you've actually placed your backpack on the ground, and then also when you return to that same spot, and then just deciding to take with you those things that you do want to bring back, and also knowing very well why you bring them back. You just don't, do it very intentionally. It's a lot of intentionality in every step.
And also, actually, just to point to how your nose, where your nose is pointing as well. Like you're probably pointing your nose towards the center of the meadow as you're putting your backpack down, and as you're leaving, your nose is probably, you're probably looking the other way.
Yeah.
How different the world is looking when you.
Oh yeah.
There's one approach or theory or whatever you want to call it, a model that also captures quite a lot of what we're talking about, and that's the theory U, or the U model and the U process, where the bottom of the U is the place where you, after having observed, you, in a way, you retreat and reflect to. And then once you decide to leave that place, you enter both a place and an attitude and an energy of acting, of doing. But that bottom of the U, the retreat and reflect, it's the same in the OODA loop, I guess, thinking as well, is I would say, quite similar to what we're talking about when we talk about the antechamber. And again, if we go back to the history or the background around theory U, that also has a lot of links to the kind of retreat and reflect processes of a number of indigenous cultures and other approaches, other ways of being and thinking. The one difference perhaps would be that for us, since we come to this from our starting point, our conversations, this isn't quite the same as, I mean, you can say that retreat and reflect on your own and doing a vision quest or a, you know, 27-day solo is also a conversation that you have with your inner self or with the spirits around or whatever. But we're, at least in most of our conversations, we're a little more down to earth in the sense that these are conversations that we believe in the power of conversations. And maybe just one more thing to add, and we don't know, but we think that these conversations really, I mean, they deserve to be physical face-to-face conversations. Yes, you can have online groups, and especially during the last three, 4 years, I think we've all been in very powerful virtual circles on Zoom or Teams or whatever. But I think for the kinds of conversations that we're talking about, it needs to take time, and it needs the non-verbal communication and connection that comes from being physically together in, you know, in a particular place. So maybe moving from the where to the how, and think a little bit about. So, you know, what can be done to at least increase the chance, increase the probability for a moment together to be, you know, a moment of exploration, discovery, and mutual learning. Again, I think many of us can recall experiences of very, you know, powerful, good conversations. Some of them have just happened. You know, there was something in the air that evening when we sat outdoors on that terrace and someone started talking about something, and then we got going, and then, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours later, we were still there and we were just full of insights and full of energy, et cetera, et cetera. That can happen, but sometimes it's not unimportant to have spent a little bit of time thinking about, you know, so what makes for good explorative conversations. And I don't know, just to say, to spark us off with one, I think, a very important prerequisite for good conversations is to make sure that there are multiple perspectives around the circle or around the table or in the conversation. Someone once said, it is people not like us who make us grow. And since this is very much about growth and discovery, I think we can all feel how limited it would be to just be in a circle with, you know, five clones of myself who've read the same books and look at the world in the same way. So having that diversity is extremely important. Ylva, do you want to reflect or share some other thoughts around, so, you know, how do we do to have good conversations in the antechamber?
Yeah, I suddenly got really tired, but I think I can pick myself up again. And what I keep, you know, because I keep, I'm right now on a roll where I explore different ways how to try out new cosmologies, and trying out new cosmology is not entirely safe sometimes, but it's also very weird. If you come from like the place of the default of conversation one, or so what I've been doing is during the past year, except for the drum journey work that, or at least the journey work that I've been doing for many years, I've been exploring different types of rituals and ceremonies for the experience, the practical experience of agency within others that would normally not be considered as having agency. For example, a building, a place, and I've even done that in consulting projects where we have been going into a deep meditation in order to meet with Genius Loki, which is spirit of place, which is it's a concept, which is a thing within architecture, and but it's got history back to Roman times. And so for a particular project with a place, we also, other than doing a lot of creative workshops on what could be this place in 10 years, we also consulted Genius Loki and got some responses and brought those suggestions into the work that we were doing. And around how to do this, of course, there's many ways, but building on ritual theory, Arnold von Gemnet, but also Liminality and Victor Turner, I would, there's like the three basics, which is the threshold and before, and then you enter, and then you are inside the chamber, and then you exit. Or you are inside the ritual, and then you exit the ritual. So you leave your normal world behind, you enter the other world, and then you leave, and you come back, just like you described with the meadow. But I would like to add two more stages, which is very essential if you do this, especially if you do it in a professional setting, which is what I did, that you have a pre-stage and you also have a post-stage. So the pre-stage is the framing and the safety, and where the post-stage would be the integration and reflecting on the experience, not only about on the findings that you had, but also on the experience itself and yourself in relationship to that. So I don't know. Was it? Practical enough in this? Do you need more?
Why don't you just be extremely practical? And I can be that as well in other examples, but around, so, you know, what happens during 2 or 3 hours in that kind of a conversation? Sorry, Amit, you were...
Yeah, I just there's something that's, my attention is drawn to the tiredness. I'm wondering if there's some intelligence there. Like, it feels like it's not insignificant. I don't know. That's my, because I also felt a shift.
Yeah.
As we moved into the how.
Yeah.
Do you want to explore?
You know what? Okay, let's explore, and now let's explore in a really, really open way. Thank you for asking this, because I also felt there's information here, but how am I going to handle this when we're recording in the conversation we're having, is that the time, you know, because we switch now, and
yeah,
One take is because this is me, and it's really because the how is not to be considered a how as in step-by-step guide anymore, because going into these spaces is actually considered by many, many cultures a holy act. This is not something that you give just a manual to anyone and then you do it, at least in the way that when I do it. And there needs to be a respect around these types of explorations, I think. And now I can feel some lightness coming back. But there might be more. What are you sensing, Amit and Alexander?
I think that's such an important, because even what you were bringing in as the first point, Alexander, like this idea of diversity or like multiple perspectives and so forth, and how even such quote unquote basic concepts are so incredibly misused and mishandled in our current world, and how when we pair these types of explorations that are, well, to me, they are sacred. The conversations where we are really placing ourselves at the mercy of the mystery or at the mercy of life or like whatever, where we're dealing in flows through us, where I am just vessel, like where I am empty, like those types of contexts, it takes something from us. As we do that, it gives us something, but a prerequisite is that it's a capacity, it's a cultivation of the instrument by which we engage in this process with, and of course with a skilled facilitator or guide or whatever it might be, some of that can be mitigated. And I kind of feel like for me at least, when we're in the antechamber, the antechamber kind of, And this is just my perception of it, but it's like when something happens, when we have a person that is the main channel, and a lot of what I'm looking for at the moment in those conversations, in the conversation too, is to not have that, is when the space itself, when our field itself can carry that channel. That to me is when it really shifts and really moves, and where I have deep learning and deep discovery. And so I think that the disclaimer is warranted for, it pisses me off sometimes, the lack of reverence that we have for this type of process and for this type of practice.
Yeah, I'm almost crying now.
Yeah. An entry point to this that I often come back to is the notion that these kinds of conversations exist for mutual learning, for the learning of every participant in the conversation. And that includes the more than human participants. Because by looking at it that way, the moment becomes a very important, at least potentially a very important, and as you say, almost sacred moment. Because this is the moment when I or you or others, or maybe the you know, the non-humans who in different ways are that we open for whose participation in the conversation we open, that a new learning comes, that we learn together. Nora Bateson calls this simathesy, the act of learning together. She had to come up with a new word because there isn't a word for that. And if you expand that with the deep, deep respect, and as both of you say, almost the sacredness of the holiness of the moment of this is a moment when we all can learn, then I think you capture some of this very special, this special nature. And of course, this also invites the other question is, so is there anything I can do to increase the possibility, the probability of learning together, the probability of simathesy taking place in this conversation? Well, at one level, no, because it's, let's call, you know, it's magic or whatever. But still, there are certain things that you can at least do to make sure that the obstacles to learning are, to mutual learning are removed. But when you think about it, moments of insights, moments of learning, especially moments of almost immediate learnings, if I look back over my life, I mean, some of those moments are just so powerful. And that, I guess, are the moments of you know, liminality in a way. When I left one way of looking at something and stepped into another, hopefully richer or better way of looking at things.
Yeah, and that to me is very precise, like the mutual learning. And I just wanted to differentiate between, let's say, education, like schooling.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is someone that is shaping you. That's what education is, and sort of the way that we've interacted with it. It's people being shaped by someone or by something, by an agenda, by a curriculum, by something. That's not what we're talking about.
No.
And that also, I mean, the mutual learning, at least to my understanding, and that's again where I feel we often go wrong, is that a mutual learning setting can't have a predetermined conclusion. It has to be an exploration. And what the holding is about is that it's about the process and it's about the safety. And maybe it's about what you were beginning to unwrap there a little bit, like in terms of the pre and the post, like the framing and then the threshold and the inside and the exit and the post and the integration. And we can maybe recover and untangle some knots or offer perspectives in terms of what seemed to be very fixed, is there was like a very intense experience that overwhelmed us or something. We might be able to deal with or start not unraveling, but at least loosening some of those things so that they can be dealt with constructively post a significant experience. But that's very, very different from, let's say, a safe space. It's very different from, the framing of education, I think.
Yeah, it's like those liminal rooms or antechamber, this antechamber, it's, one can regard it as a method, and when regarding it as a method only, then it's easier that it becomes like a thing that you use, like a tool or something. But it's not only that. I mean, it's that's part of it, but it's also that it's a collaborator in itself. It has agency itself, and in collaborating with the antechamber process or this liminal work when you're doing it, it will alter your perception because you do it, and it will morph you. It itself will morph you, and so it's also becoming when you're doing it, because it's a way of being, that it's actually a becoming of sorts. So when you decide to do it, you also decide to melt in a way. You dissolve, and it's a way of allowing it to dissolve you. using the word it with like a quotation marks, because it's a you, it's a subject. Oh, I've totally lost so many people now. I don't know when I said this. Or maybe I didn't.
Probably.
Yeah.
No, maybe you didn't. Or maybe they should be lost. I don't know. But yeah, no. It kind of goes back to the who point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like, if you aren't curious about these things, then that's okay. Or you know, that's also okay, actually. How does the tiredness feel now?
Is it, I'm good.
It's
gone.
We're good. Okay.
Yeah, this is the last return thing with a collaborator. I needed to get that through as well.
Yeah.
So, I think we've spent some time exploring the antechamber, looking at what's in there, how's it furnished, what does it look like. We haven't quite gotten to the, you know, what color is the paint on the walls, or is there any art in it, or is there any are there any windows that need to be opened, or et cetera? But I think at least we've hopefully taken some people by the hand and walked into the antechamber together. And I think, at least to me, what's important to realize is that this isn't, it's not a corridor with only one entrance and one exit. It's more like, well, it's liminal, so it's more like a threshold. And when you stand at that threshold and you look one way, if you look towards the past, that is, again, where System 1, the world as we know it, is. And then when you turn around 180 degrees and look in the other direction, that's where, you know, all the possible futures are. Again, going back to the quote that you gave earlier, Amit, from Dugald Hind in The Dark Mountain, about that the end of the world as we know isn't the end of the world. What's the new world? That's what's on the other side of the antechamber. That's what is there for us to explore and to look for, and of course, primarily to build.
Something around, at least I'll speak for where I'm at in my deepening of my process. So, but I would argue that if you can see it, that's probably not it. Like, there might be other ways of feeling it, or being with it, or sensing that it's coming through, or chat, like be from it or something like that. But I don't think sight, if you step into it from a Systems 1 or from a modernity, if you step into the antechamber from modernity, I think very few people at least will be able to see what's there. Then look beyond again. At least that would be my invitation/experience. Yeah.
In Nora Bateson's latest book, which was just released a few weeks ago, some of the texts in it speak to precisely these kinds of this kind of exploration. And there are a few lines in particular that I had made a note of in preparation for this conversation around precisely this widening of perspectives that comes from the learning. So those will be my final words, just reading a few of the lines from one of her texts, if that's okay. But before that, maybe we want to close in a more normal way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see this room before me, and you were in that room in May, Alexander, And within that room, we created a room in a room. And there we entered the cave of eternal echoes, or the cave that exists beyond time, and learned things in there. And then we were guided outside of that cave. It had certain smells and sounds to it as well. It's just there in front of me, and I'll have to give them that picture, my final words.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'll let your words be the last ones that are heard in this podcast, Alexandra. And just immense gratitude for this conversation. And there's a lightness and a joy that bubbles through when I meet people and get to talk from a place that I feel is beginning to have the reverence for this exploration that I feel so deeply, like that deep respect and that deep reverence and that deep commitment to that which we don't know yet, that which is the mystery and that which is beyond. So thank you for showing up and for speaking to me now. It feels very different from the person that had the first conversation. Thanks.
Yeah, so I'll read a few lines from one of Nora Bateson's poems called What I Learned. I have been seeing one small piece of the landscape, a branch of a forest, believing it. Then the forest revealed, and I feel that I have been so inept. It is a reminder of the cost of thinking my knowing is anything. I am learning that learning is the healing, not backtracking, not rehashing, not splitting words and attempting to save face, not apologizing. The only currency here is movement.